Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. I have the one and only Alejandro Rojas going to be joining me for about 20 minutes or so. And then after that, I have our first guest for about 30-something minutes, and that's Erling Strand from Norway. He was on, we recorded twice, the second time because the file was corrupt the first time. And so it's late at night, very late at night for him, and that's why he wanted to pre-record. So I will be in the chat room during that time. And after that, we have Seth Shostak coming in live. And I'm going to be taking calls on Zoom. I'll tell you how that'll work. I want to thank everyone that supports the show. Anyone can do that. All you have to do is go over to podcastufo.com, and you can see the information over there, or Patreon. I also want to say that we have another blog this week from Charles Lear, and that's UFOs in China. So check that out. He's researched it pretty well. It's interesting. There's that story about the airport. I remember they closed the airport over there. That would seem like it was just a few years ago. All interesting stuff. But for now, we are going to get in a little bit of a chat with Alejandro. How are you, Alejandro?
Hola, hola. Doing good. Hello, Martinites. Is that what your followers are called? Do they have a name?
Oh, Martinites? No.
Martinites sounds a bit cultish, but you might like that to be a leader of a cult.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, that's my calling. No, we do have some great listeners, and I don't know why, but lately I've gotten some wonderful email in the last couple of days, so I want to thank all those people sending kind words. And, you know, it makes up one kind email makes up for the 20 troll emails and comments that we both are familiar with.
Unfortunately. But yeah, I like that. Martinites. I'm going to call him Martinites. So, and I'm also excited. I think it's going to be interesting, especially if you ask Seth Shostak if he knows about the Hesnelin lights and what he knows, the contrast between what Dr. Strand has to say and Dr. Shostak ought to be interesting.
Yes, yes. I like talking to Erling because, you know, he's basically a scientist, as you know, because you know him, that is taking a chance of ridicule or people not taking him seriously on other things. So I do appreciate it. And I think, you know, the best thing that he does is he gets his students involved. They get to witness, you know, the things. Sometimes they get to see mm-hmm. them firsthand, which is really exciting for them. It's all good.
Yeah, that is really cool.
Yeah. So I see it. It seems like every time we talk, you have a different background.
I know.
It's your warehouse.
Yeah, I know.
Your warehouse room.
Moving. Yeah, this is where I've been doing the show for a while, but I've moved it around a bit just because, you know, I've got a new headquarters that I've moved some of my stuff to. So the old headquarters, I don't have all my cool gear here and my lights. So I don't have my lights here. So that's why the lighting's different and everything. But next week will be another location because I should be at the new headquarters. Hopefully I'll have that all set up for you too. So that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking forward to seeing that. And I bet you're really looking forward to the, you know, being settled in your new place.
Yes, I'm mostly settled in. And so just going back and forth. And I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, what's going on? It seems like the big story of this last week is about the Army situation. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So that is the big story, of course, is To the Stars working with the Army. You know, we've got that announcement maybe like a week ago, and that was from To the Stars saying they're working with the Army on this project called CRADA, CRADA, which is essentially working to examine these mysterious materials that come from UAP cases that To the Stars has been talking about. Elizondo was on Tucker Carlson recently, and he's been on other shows talking about this. So what's the deal, is what everybody's thinking. And it's, of course, this is really important and surprising. The original To the Stars announcement didn't have a lot of information. It was very kind of enigmatic. But now others have kind of examined the information. In fact, John Greenwald of the Black Vault did get a copy of the entire agreement that he posted, and there have been some comments to the media from the Army now. What's great about this is that the Army is confirming, yes, we are working with them to help analyze this material. The documentation says they're not paying To the Stars to do that. And however, they are planning on spending up to $750,000 to do the analysis, because that's the whole problem with materials analysis, is that it's very expensive. Mm. You know, people, followers of mine or yours, you know, you've had Robert Powell on quite a bit, who's done a lot of attempts at material analysis and talks about the expense. And that has limited what we've been able to do, even for materials that have been around for a very long time, such as the alleged arts parts or the so-called arts parts, which were these materials that were sent to Art Bell many years ago. And then Linda Howe kind of took over the investigation of them. And now To the Stars is looking at them as well. Some of the members of To the Stars, when they were with Bigelow, National Institute of Discovery Sciences, also took a look at this material. But they're still, you know, inquiring whether or not, you know, these are something mysterious, because there's this debate out there about whether they are or not. So the great thing is that the Army is now participating and putting some money towards this. And so hopefully now we'll be able to kind of find out more, and maybe even put to bed some of these debates to find out if some of this material actually is, you know, or does have mysterious properties, or can be proven to be from elsewhere. Or what would be especially exciting is if we could prove they're, you know, manufactured elsewhere, meaning off planet, and that the methods used to manufacture the materials are unknown to us. That would be, that's kind of the goalpost. That's what we're looking for. What's great about this, there's a couple comments. Some people have said, you know, oh, this is To the Stars trying to grab cash. But as I said earlier, this isn't something that they're going to be making money at, which is unfortunate in my view, because To the Stars needs money. Any program needs money to continue. So hopefully, you know, some funds will come in. This does alleviate them having to spend their funds on these processes. The Army will be doing that, so that's helpful. The other criticism is that, you know, that they're getting in bed with the military. And the military, you pointed out that the military, the Army has said, you know, you pointed this out on my show, it's something you saw in the document, is that the Army says, you know, they have to give a sign-off 30 days ahead of time before any communication is going out about the work that the Army is going to be helping with. Some have said, oh, they're just going to hide the information. The good part of that is that, well, and the other thing is that makes sense. Why would the Army want, you know... Tom DeLonge has said some odd things in the past, and, you know, I think the Army, with any partner, would want to know what's going to be said about their work before it's out there. I mean, that just makes sense if they're going to have a partnership. The other thing is I personally feel, from working with these guys and from what I've seen, that they do want to be as transparent as possible. They did a Vice interview where Carrie DeLonge, who's Tom DeLonge's sister, who does a lot of their PR, she was talking about that's a big deal for them to be as transparent as possible. And although people have felt they haven't been, really, I think that they have been as much as possible. We've seen a lot. They talk to the media a lot, really, and have given a lot of information. The television show Unidentified has revealed a lot. So I think at least we are having an outlet for information coming to the public about all of these studies. So really, and plus, you know, we've heard from the Navy now about UAP studies and their positive aspect. And now we have input from the Army. We still haven't heard from the Air Force, but hopefully we will. So I think it's an amazing time that we have, you know, these defense agencies coming forward to say that UAPs are a real thing. They take them seriously. And now they're participating in sort of a public facing investigation.
You know, this this cooperation, or whatever you'd want to call it, in a way to me seems unprecedented to anything I can actually picture. I'm not talking about just the UFO aspect of it. It's just that the government, the Army, is publicly willing to talk about working together, doing research of something unusual. You know, to me, it just seems unprecedented.
I agree with you. You know, the only time we had this was really the early days of the Air Force investigations into UFOs, Project Sign. At that time, there were many people associated with Project Sign that felt that UFOs were a real phenomenon, something that needed to be examined in a serious manner. In fact, you know, General Twining, it's a famous memo that he wrote along these lines that helped start Project Sign, which was prior to Project Blue Book. During that era, they actually came up with a summary where they concluded in Project Sign that, yes, UFOs are a thing. They are important. Some of them are unidentified. We haven't been able to figure out what they are. They could be of an extraterrestrial nature. They could be from an ET civilization. And the higher-ups didn't like that conclusion. And ever since then, they had a really poor attitude towards the whole topic into Project Grudge and then eventually Project Blue Book. This is well documented in Edward Ruppelt's book. He was the guy who was the first to head up Project Blue Book in 1952, the guy who coined the phrase UFO. Highly recommend that book. You could read it for free on the NICAP website, NICAP. But, you know, the Air Force took things seriously at the beginning, and then it got really negative. And then we haven't had any real official investigations that have been public facing. We've had government documents where we've been able to say, hey, it looks like you guys have taken some of these things seriously. And they've said, no, 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 when obviously they have. It's only recently that we've had this, you know, admission that these investigations have gone on. And then, you know, now we have the Navy and the Army taking positive steps towards doing this research, which is, like you said, unprecedented. It's incredible. It's kind of interesting. We haven't heard from the Air Force at all up to this point, so we don't know really what they're thinking. They did have a comment on one story. I forgot what they said. They didn't really say much except for, you know, that something along the lines of that that really indicating that actually they felt some of these cases truly were unidentified. So I think that's interesting. So we'll see. I think that the future, I don't think this is, you know, this is just the beginning of all of this. And people keep saying that. I think To the Stars and Luis Elizondo keep saying that. And that appears to be true because more and more positive news of investigation and research going on has been coming out. And, you know, what I would tell people to look forward to is typically when these things happen, you know, then news and information about findings rolls out for a couple years because really things get started. During the beginning, you don't hear much when the real research is going on. Once results start coming back, you start to hear a little bit. And then once those results are more vetted and, you know, people are prepared to actually make statements, then you hear more. That can take months, maybe a year or two. It could take a while. That may be kind of a bummer for some people who want information more quickly. Right. But the good thing is that means that this is going to be in the headlines and this is going to be news for quite some time, you know, in the future.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there an article that just came out that said something about they think they can explain the videos and ended up kind of associating with the Navy's, you know, patents, which are just theories at this point?
Yeah, I mean, they're not anything, in my opinion, credible along those lines. Really, we've had people make that suggestion, but not in a credible way where they can demonstrate that fully. Mm. Really, I think one of the people who's done the best analysis along those lines is Tyler Rogaway of The Drive, and you could read his stories. And he suggested perhaps there are some technologies that the U.S. is using that could answer some of these questions. However, he's examined those patents, and he's had physicists look at it. He does not, and the physicists he's talked to don't believe that this technology is actually something that has been developed or even could ever be developed. And he agrees with that, and I think he makes some great arguments there. He's obviously very detailed in his analysis. And however, And he, even though he suspects perhaps there could be, you know, a human explanation, he always admits that, you know, if we find out that humans created objects or devices or aircraft that can maneuver the way these Navy jet fighters explain it, that would be extraordinary. That would be groundbreaking. And that technology would be years and years and years more advanced than what we currently have. So it would be an amazing, extraordinary story in development if that were the case. And he also admits, though, that he has no indication that that has happened, that we have been able to develop anything like that. And so for him, it's a real head scratcher. And, you know, for a mainstream journalist who writes about aviation and defense, you know, he's really kind of like in a bind. He's an honest journalist. And he's like, on the one hand, it's got to be something human. On the other hand, it can't be because there's no way we have technology like this. So, you know, that's what's got him so compelled to really cover this story. And I think that's a really good place to look for developments along those lines.
Right, right. And several years ago, do you remember, I'm trying to remember, just slipping my mind right now, the gentleman from Skunk Works that said, right now we have technology to take E.T. home. Do you remember who that is?
Well, that's secondhand information.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It is, and, you know, I think there's been some good, that was, you know, a couple MUFON guys, Jan Harzan, was there to hear that statement, along with, I forget, he also works with him. He wrote the kind of beginner's guide to UFOs. I forget his name right now, but he was there also, a friend of Jan's who is an engineer. Now, there have been other quotes that are similar that we've heard from Ben Rich. And however, you know, if you hear the full statements, they really don't indicate that he felt there was technology that was ET related or back engineered from ETs, but that he was very proud of the technologies that they had developed at Skunk Works. But really, I don't think there's enough evidence to show that he meant, you know, we back engineered alien technology, nor that he, you know, believes that the technology, you know, they developed did such things or could. You know, people use it for an excuse for this space race or something like that. I mean, it's interesting. His predecessor, who I can't remember his name right now, who really helped develop Area 51, did have a UFO sighting. And he took UFOs very seriously. He said what they saw was not, you know, ours. It couldn't be. And they would know. They were developing the cutting edge aviation technology of the time. So I think that that's an example of where I think they saw a true delineation between the UFOs that were observed and the technologies they were developing. Think they were two separate things.
Okay. So I can't believe this. We're out of time already. Can you believe that? Okay. That went really fast.
It always does.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I'll be talking to you next week, and good luck with your moving around you're doing there.
All right. Thanks.
Talk
to you later.
All right. Take care. All right, everyone, so hang in there. We're coming up with our next guest, and his name is Erling Strand. He has a very interesting science background, and he actually was one of the founders of the Hezelen Project. We're going to be talking about all of that, and so hang in, and here he is right now. All right, my first guest, this is a pre-record, and I am doing that because it's going to be the middle of the night by the time the show goes live for Erling Strand over in Norway. And Erling, welcome to the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, this is our second time of pre-recording. We don't have to get into that, but we had a bad file, so I really, really appreciate this. So I want to start out, we're going to be talking about the Hezelen lights, the phenomena, and you have quite a background. Can you give the listener your basic background and what got you interested in this this phenomena, actually?
Well, my ordinary job, I'm lecturing at a university college. I have a lot of students and doing lecturing at that college. But I'm also the project manager of Project Hestdalen, which started many years ago. And now in my position, I am using my student in the work of finding out what it can be out up in Hestdalen. So, and Project Hestdalen is what it started already back in 1983. So we during the years we have done a lot of work up there. Maybe you know Hestdalen is a small Norwegian valley, about 15 kilometers long, and about now it's about 100 inhabitants up there. Small valley, but even though it's small, a lot of sightings of strange phenomena. We call it phenomena. Some mostly lights, different types of lights, and even some have seen also daylight object, but they are very few compared with the lights. So we, in our study, we have focus on the lights, which are more easy to see mm-hmm. up there.
So we can talk about the different things, which really is puzzling because, you know, if it's a natural phenomenon, it's strange that it would be different types of sightings that these people do see and have been actually filmed. But as far as you, did you have an interest in exploring this topic? I know you have a great science background, but I mean, did you have an interest early on and you know, trying to figure out what these type of phenomena are?
Yes, what brought me into the topic was when I was a student at the University in Trondheim. And in the broad daylight, I saw a flying disc flying over my head. And I saw this very clear, and I could see it all details. And I was very surprised, and I didn't expect anything like that. So I wanted to figure out what could that be. And at that time, that was back in 1978, before Hestdalen, when I was a student. Before that, I have not been into the UFO topic at all. It was strange for me. I haven't been part of any groups or anything. When I saw this flying disc coming over my head, I started to wonder, and that brought me into this topic. Mm-hmm. And that was and that was made a big impression on me. Hestdalen, that started with a lot of sightings very late 1981. In this small valley. It's located about 120 kilometers south of Trondheim city and in the southern part of Norway, towards the Swedish border, not so very far from the Swedish border, and also close to a famous town. Røros is a famous Norwegian town, about 35 kilometers north of that. Well, anyway, this small valley in December 1981, the inhabitants up there started to see many sightings happen nearly every day. They could see it close to their houses, down in the valley, down to the river, up on the mountainside, hillside, and up in the sky. Sometimes it moved close to their houses and so on. And the high intensity started, well, December 1981, but it lasted for years. So until it, I think it was late 1984, it decreased a lot. So, but now it's in the order of 20 observations a year. But at that time, in the early 80s, it was 20 observations a week.
Amazing. Now, has anything changed geographically in some type of way that could, you know, always looking for, you know, a possible answer to these things? Could something have changed that would have made that happen?
Well, we have studied a lot of what is happening in that small valley. Why Hessdal? And well, it's near, you think of the geophysical part. We know it's a lot of minerals in the valley. You have copper, you have iron, you have sulfur, and other kinds of minerals too. And so the ground is not ordinary as other places. It's a lot of minerals in it. But, you know, there are other places too which have a lot of minerals in the ground. So it's hard to see the connection with the minerals in the ground and the sightings. We don't know that. But anyway, we know that that's one of the specific things in the Hessdal Valley. And we have even now tried to go into that more closely by having geophysicists from both France and Greek coming up to Norway and in Hessdal and doing investigation to see if we can come closer to the solution.
Now, I know there are other places in, you know, the world where there are, you know, lights like similar to this, like, for instance, Brown Mountain. I know there's a bunch of them, but, you know, Brown Mountain, it comes to mind. And when you said copper, I know that there's a high copper concentration in that area. And I'm just wondering, when, you know, you said earlier that people are seeing different things. If this is some type of energy created from, say, something, you know, unknown but natural, can you kind of explain what you meant by you said that people would see different things?
Well, that's one of the trouble in finding one solution is the description and the behavior of the different lights or the different observation types. They're very, very different. For instance, about the lights, you have these flashes which last up to maximum a second, mostly much less than 1 second. So it's very hard to see, but they're very strong, so they can be captured on cameras. They can move, but mostly they are flashes, which just happen around in the valley. That's one type. They're mostly white, sometimes blue, and they can be far away and they can be close, and they can be towards the hillside, can be down in the river, Well, these flashes is the most observation is of those flashes. Mm-hmm. We wasn't aware of those in the beginning when we started the first fieldwork back in 1984, but later we come aware of those. The second type is yellow balls of light moving around, sometimes slowly, sometimes fast. The shape can be all different kinds of shapes, not always round or oval shapes. It can also be other figures. And also sometimes they report that they see some balls of light inside the big light moving around. And sometimes also these balls of mostly yellow light can have other lights onto it. And these can move around, stand still for minutes, move slowly around up to 2 hours. And they can even go down close to the ground and illuminate the ground beneath it. And of course, they can move fast too. On one such happening, we measured the speed of 30,000 kilometers an hour.
Wow.
Well, this is the second type. The second type with the ball of light, mostly yellow, moving around, can be split in more types, of course, but we have considered to keep them in one type because, you have all the different speeds. You have the duration of from minutes to hours. You have all the different shapes, and you have the... So it has been discussed, maybe we should split them in more types. But I keep it in one type. That was the second type. And the third type is more when you have several lights together. It seems that they are connected to something. Because when these lights are moving, they move together. As if there is on to something. Also, sometimes when people have seen this type of light when it's not completely dark outside, they have explained that these lights is connected to something. They call it the black object, some kind of object which they don't see when it's completely dark, but when it's not completely dark, they can see it. That's the third type of light. So that's and it's difficult to find one solution who fit all these types of description. We have thought of maybe we are dealing with different answers. Could be. We have done a lot of measurements too, and some of the measurements can point in one direction, and some other measurements can point in another direction. So it's hard to understand this that there is only one solution and one type of light.
Now the building that you can see when you go online, you see there's this building. It's not too big, but there's equipment in there. So what type of equipment is in there that you're trying to get data from?
Well, first of all, we had the field work back in 1984 with a lot of instruments up there, lasted for nearly 1 month. And we have a similar field work back in January, February 1985, two field work. And after that, the intensity decreased a lot, so we didn't have any field work from 1985 until we heard that they still continued to be up there. I was going up in the valley back in 1993, 8 years after our field work, and they wanted to know what had happened with our measurement. And when I had the presentation for the local inhabitants up in Hessdalen back in 1993, they said to me that, well, it still continues. There is still lights up there. Oh, I say, I haven't heard anything. Well, they said, we don't tell it anymore because we were ridiculed the first year, so we don't want to be ridiculed again.
Wow.
Well, anyway, I decided to start a project again, and we built an automatic station, which was put up in 1998, and it sent data directly onto internet. People can find the data on www.hessdalen.org. And every morning, new data comes in. And also people can stay home. There's live stream up, cameras also up there from this station.
Wow.
This station is running. But also we do another thing, and that is to bring students up in the valley with a lot of instruments as field work, as we did in 84 and 85. Now we use our students and also some younger students as well, and they stay up in the valley for 14 days and 1 week, 14 days in the autumn and 1 week in the spring. And intense. With instruments,
wow.
lot of computers, lot of different cameras. We have other instruments too, magnetometer and so on. So they do a lot of measurements during those 2 weeks. And the students think that it's very exciting because, well, sometimes they see something. And, well, when you see it for yourself, it makes something with you when you see it yourself.
I think there's a film on YouTube where it must be the students and they're filming it and they're all like, wow. You know, I mean, they're really, you could tell they're excited. Yes, it would be. Really amazing. And there was one, you mentioned the different colors. There was one I saw that it was kind of an orange color, like an orange orb. And there's a lot of people around the world reporting seeing orange orbs. But I only saw that one, and the rest of them, you know, looked like you said, were yellow or white looking. Now, when you said that there were some that appeared to be connected, or they seem to be in sequence as far as their movements, and possibly to a dark object. Has there been anyone that's ever, considered that their movements and what they're doing is under intelligent control of any kind?
Well, intelligent control is it's a possibility, but it's very hard to prove. And if you claim it's intelligent, it's very difficult to claim such kind of things. You can maybe indicate that some can have some kind of intelligent, but I'm careful doing that because it's how should you define an intelligent? Well, we, for instance, we had one happening. We pointed a light towards a flashing light, and it changed the flashing frequency.
Really?
We used a laser beam, and it was a response to our laser. And also 1 week later, we use a red laser. You can see a red laser spot on the ground by our feet moving around. And this is far out in the countryside. So, well, you can mention some, and also, well, some people have they claim there has been some kind of communication, but it's hard to prove. And it's difficult, and it doesn't happen that much, very few, compared with all the hundreds of sightings we have with light, and which we try to document, we try to get data of these lights to see if we can get closer to a solution.
I see. I want to talk just a minute about, you know, the people that live in the area there that have been witnessing this. You mentioned earlier about ridicule. I'll talk about that a little bit too. But has anyone ever reported that they actually saw something land on the ground that you're aware of?
Well, yes, but compared with all the hundreds other things, very few. Mm-hmm. I think only one, which I can remember just now, which describes such happening. So it's not much. No, very, 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 very little of that kind of things.
What about any like trace evidence of any of the happenings there?
Well, that's also very little. There is some which can be traced, but that can be maybe something else too. It doesn't necessarily need to be of some craft or light or anything. There are a few such happenings which are strange, but we focus mostly on what's happening most, and we focus also most on what we can get data out of. Mm-hmm. Because, well, about the tracks, very no one has reported directly seeing anyone, any object coming down, making a track and going up again. No one has told anything of such thing to me from Hessdalen.
Mm-hmm. And how early were people reporting seeing something that you're aware of? I mean, were there people that say it was generational, you know, their father or grandfather or someone remembered something way back?
Yes, there are some few stories, because when this started with this high activity, people started to talk about it, of course, and we have asked old people if they remember anything from old days. And we have got some few stories from old people who have said that, well, yes, I saw something for many years ago. So, and there is also a couple of written local history books which indicate some kind of light. And I would believe that probably it has always been going on there, it was known and became known from people around the world when it happened so very much. There was some name it UFO flap, which lasted for 3 years up there.
Hmm. Yeah, you're saying 20 times or something like that a week or something. I mean, that's really amazing, and it's good that you know, there are people like you taking this seriously, and you know, someone in science. And speaking of that, you were talking about ridicule. Have you yourself ever had taken any ridicule because of looking into this particular phenomenon?
No, not what I'm aware of. Yeah. Not what I'm aware of or think of. Because I know there is something. I went up there in September 82 the first time and saw it myself. Mm-hmm. So I knew there was something. So when if someone tried to ridicule that, well, that's their problem. It's not mine. And I knew there was something. And I knew also that because at that time I was working as a scientist in Oslo. And when I saw it myself the first time, it made a big impression on me because I was far out in the countryside, in the not any houses around, in the hillside. And then you see this huge light coming, and that you remember that.
Yeah,
you can imagine, and it's very strong, and it's moving around and stop and last for 1.5 hours before it disappeared. And so I knew it was something. And when I come back to my work and discussed this with my companions, and I was warned that be careful to involve in UFO research, because that can destroy your career. Because well, at that time, if you are studying UFO was not seriously taken at that time. Yeah. So we later decided it's much more easy to talk about the Hessdalen phenomena instead of UFO, because UFO, the word UFO, has been in a way destroyed. And it's not taken seriously. But if you use other words, it's much more easy. It's much more, the scientists take it more seriously. So that's, we right, call it the Hessdalen phenomena from now on. So that helped a lot.
It's too bad you have to do that, and there's many examples of that. And one of the people I was trying to get on this show was Dr. Richard Haynes, and he basically told me flat out that the title of my show is Podcast UFO, and he was sorry that he couldn't be on my show. And because of that, you know, so people are using UAP and other terms to call it, but UFO data. So that is something you're involved in, and they actually use that word in that, but it's a group of scientists and people with a PhD that are actually taking this seriously and looking to collect data on it. Alexander Wendt, Rodiger, I think, is involved in that. Robert Powell, a bunch of really interesting people, including yourself.
Yes, that's important work they're doing. They are scientists, and they want data. Scientists want data, and their work is getting data, and that's the name also, UFO data. So that fit very well with my thinking too. My main goal is to get the data, the data which can lead to a solution. So the UFO data group is very important, and we hope we can get more funding for this. The outcome can be very, very big, but of course it's a high risk though in putting a lot of money into it, because you never know for sure if you get a big breakthrough to find a solution.
That's right.
But if you do, then the payoff can be enormous. So I would encourage people who want to contribute both to Project Hessdalen or to UFO data, they should do it. And they have if they look at ufodata.net, they can get in contact with them there.
Yes, yeah. It must be frustrating to you that more scientists do not want to find out, or do not look into the data. And one of the things, you know, I've heard other people say is, you know, it's something that can't be solved easily. And when something can't be solved easily or solved within a time limit, then, you know, there's no such thing as funding for something like that. And So there's a lot of people privately funding, you know, the look into it. But do you ever get frustrated that more people of science are not, you know, looking at this in a serious way?
Well, yeah, I know there is a lot of scientists interested in the topic. But of course, scientists need to get funding for their work.
And one
of the arguments against this is that you never know when it happens. It's a big risk. You can have the chance to not get any data at all.
Yeah.
But if you see on another side, you have some areas which have a lot of sightings. And even if you are out there with instruments and you don't get any observation as such, but you can do investigation of the area, the geophysical thing, and find out what's the reason why it happened here. So that can be done. And also now you can get some automatically system. You don't need to be there out in the field personally all the time. So you can get some equipment which doesn't necessarily cost so very much money to run automatically and send data whenever something happening. So that should be possible.
Now, one last thought here is, and then we're gonna end this part of the show, and that is, have you thought about looking into other places that are similar to this? Have you to do comparisons?
Well, yes, of course, about founding again, but I've been lucky to been to both Mexico and several places in the States and also Australia, and have instruments with me, look at and seen the observation at these places too. It seems to be the same thing as in Hessdal, so we are probably talking about the same reason, the same thing. And there is some similarities. I think there's a lot of similarities between the different places in the world where it's happening. But why these places are so active, we haven't found a solution to that yet.
Right.
And for instance, the minerals in the ground, which could, we know there's a lot of minerals in the ground in Hessdal. We have also mapped how the minerals is located in the valley. And of course, we have found out that. But from there to the actual light itself is difficult. And there's a lot of proposals too, or hypotheses about what could this be, but as I said, one of the problems is that some hypotheses can point in one direction and other one in other directions, so it's hard to find one solution which fit to all. Well, one possibility is that, of course, it can be a different thing we are studying. It's not necessary the same solution, only one solution, can be different solutions, different things. But the question is, so why does all this happen in a small valley in Norway?
Mm-hmm.
So that when you say that all these different types happen in one valley, it's very easy to say that there must be some connection. And
Absolutely. Very, very interesting. Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for coming back to re-record. And so, everyone, hang in there. We'll be right back in a few minutes after this break with Dr. Seth Shostak.
Thank you.
Hey, Seth, how are you?
Hi, sorry, I'm a little late. I had 4 o'clock on my calendar instead of 3:55.
That's okay, you're here. And so we're glad to have you on. And I appreciate it. We had a number of are you back? There you are.
I am.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a number of questions come rolling in, and you know, one of them already, and one of them was have you ever heard of the last guest we had, Dr. Erling Strand? I'm sorry, he's not a doctor. He's got his master's in science. But Erling Strand over in Norway, have you ever heard of the Hasdalen lights?
Yes. Those I've heard of. I haven't heard of that particular person, but I've certainly heard of the lights.
Yeah. And, you know, I really enjoyed the talk with him because I know you're a science-based guy, and it's really hard for you to talk about speculating of any kind. You know, you've been on the show before, so it's no surprise. And he doesn't either, which I thought was nice. He just wants the data. That's what they're trying to gather. They're trying to figure out what they are. You know, there very possibly could be something, you know, a natural phenomenon, but it's awful hard to say when there's different things happening. But anyway, this you haven't been on for a number of years, so I wanted to welcome you back. And can you give the listener that I have a lot of new listeners to the show too, just a quick nutshell of your background and what got you interested in SETI and looking out there for intelligent life?
Well, my background is in physics and astronomy. I've studied both, and I have degrees in both. I was actually involved in what's called radio astronomy for many, many years, in which we were doing research on, well, galaxies, actually. And I measured the rotation of galaxies. That was my thesis work. And I continued that for a couple of years even afterwards because the galaxies were all rotating a little bit too fast. And that was an indication that there was something that we now call dark matter in these galaxies. So radio astronomy. But, of course, the techniques of radio astronomy are rather similar to the techniques used in SETI. So when I moved to California after living in Europe for a while, I went to a party over in Berkeley, and some people saw me there that were working in SETI, and they called me up and asked me if I wanted a job at the SETI Institute. And here I am.
Wow. So, I bet you that was exciting for you, really.
Well, it was. I mean, as it turned out, I happened to have had a dwelling that was only, you know, 2 miles from the SETI Institute. So not only was it exciting, it also had the benefit of being convenient.
Oh, wow. And that's in, is that Mountain View?
It is in Mountain View. Mountain View is probably most famous these days for Google. Google is headquartered here.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think it's, eBay's not there, is it? Is eBay there? Or they're right nearby.
No, eBay is fairly nearby. The last time I saw an eBay building was down in San Jose. So that's about 10 miles from where I'm sitting.
That's right. That's right. So I have become a big fan of your podcast. We'll talk about that a little bit. But Big Picture Science, I absolutely love it. You get some fantastic guests. It's well produced, very high quality, and really, really, really interesting topics. And I have to say, I listened to about five or so podcasts. That's about it. And your podcast is one of them. I always loved your sense of humor too.
And that's what keeps me awake, Martin.
Now, I remember you and I debated UFOs. I'm up to 370 shows or something like that at this point. But I mean, I was in, I think, like 40 or 60 shows, something like that. And I was still green, so to speak, not to say that I could debate any better, but you're a very good debater when it comes to this subject. We can get into a little bit of that later on. But, you know, some people have asked questions, and I'm going to try to take calls later. But one of the questions was, who funds SETI? And I know originally, I believe, I should say, that NASA did originally, and now it's private funding. Is that correct?
Well, there was a NASA SETI program, and that began in the 1970s. There had certainly been SETI experiments before that, and they were just sort of informal efforts made by the radio astronomers involved. I mean, I did it myself in the 1970s. I'd be, you know, at a radio observatory making observations. And, you know, I had some telescope time and then ran out of galaxies because the galaxies are not equally distributed across the sky from the standpoint of a radio telescope. So I would occasionally look up the coordinates of nearby star systems and just point the antennas in those directions just to see if there was anything there. So those informal accounts, or efforts, I should say, were you know, the majority of early SETI work. But finally, a gentleman here at the NASA Ames Research Center, a couple of miles from where I'm sitting, actually, started to get NASA involved in it. And when I joined the SETI Institute in 1990, it was a NASA program. That ended in 1993, however.
And how was the transition over to this private funding?
Well, it was very difficult. Because although the NASA SETI program was never large, it was never more than 1/1,000th of the NASA budget. That was still a lot of money compared to what we could raise from private, you know, donors, which is what we do now. So there's very little funding for SETI. The big problem with SETI, people always ask, you know, what's the thing you would like to fix most about SETI? It's the funding, of course.
And how do you do that? I mean, one of the things and the way a lot of people that are, and there are some science-based people that are trying to figure out what people are seeing, you know, here on Earth, and the research money is so difficult to get. For a number of reasons, and the number one reason, or besides the ridicule factor, is that they need a time, like a date of solving, in order to get funding. You hear that. And so I don't want to say dangle a carrot, but how do you get someone interested in saying you fund this because we think that we are going to blah, blah, blah? How do you approach that?
Well, all we can tell them is this. There is the technology today to find signals, whether they're radio signals or flashing laser beams or something. We now have the technology that could find these things, at least at a relatively reasonable intensity, you know, strength. And no previous generation has been able to do that. So it would be a little crazy not to at least try. Can we guarantee success? No, there's no way we can guarantee success. But on the other hand, Chris Columbus couldn't guarantee success either. It's a little unclear whether he actually had success, but at least he could say he was going to try. And at some point, you have the ability to try. The other thing that I believe plays a role here is that SETI is dependent largely on computers, right? Compute power is very important. If you have more compute power, you can look at the sky very much more quickly. That sort of thing. And it turns out that the speed of SETI experiments keeps growing very rapidly, actually exponentially. So that's another encouragement to funders because, you know, whatever we're doing this year really dwarfs everything that was done up until this year. So it's a very rapidly improving experiment.
Does SETI work in concert with, say, events or possible events? Or, for instance, I remember when, I'm trying to remember what it was called, like the Dyson sphere, they were talking about that.
Yeah, probably Tabby Star.
That's it, Tabby Star. Does SETI work in concert with, you know, revelations like that? In other words, like there could be some type of activity in this direction and you focus on that direction?
Well, sure. Yes, of course. I mean, if you find an object in the sky in the course of, you know, astronomy, I mean, Tabby Star was actually in the observing list for the Kepler Space Telescope. And what was observed was that star dimmed occasionally, not regularly. If it regularly dimmed, you figure, okay, there's a planet going around it causing it to dim. But this dimming was very erratic. And in one instance, it dimmed by 22%. That's enormous. That's not a planet. No planet can dim a star by 22% by passing in front of it. I mean, even Jupiter passing in front of the sun, you know, it dims it by less than 1%, right?
Wow. 1%.
So, you know, it wasn't a planet. And the question was, what was it? And Jason Wright, who's an astronomer at Penn State, suggested, well, I mean, it could be an alien megastructure. Maybe there's a planet there with some very sophisticated beings on it that have built some giant construction in orbit around their star, and that occasionally blocks the light. So, of course, we and another SETI group also pointed our antennas in the direction of Tabby Star to see if there was anything coming from there. We didn't find anything. Of course, that doesn't prove that they're not there. But as it turns out, the whole explanation kind of became a little more obvious about a year later when people with big conventional telescopes saw that the dimming was very, very red compared to the color of the star, and that meant it was dust. So it's just, something natural. It's not ET.
It's still interesting. And now we have the James Webb is going to be going out there at some point. These are just more and more tools. Kepler made so many discoveries. You did a show about that recently where you were in Big Picture Science, where you're talking about, the discovery of Earth-like planets and the possibility of, the numbers are just staggering in just this galaxy alone. And speaking of this galaxy alone, does SETI focus on this galaxy, or does it actually look around? I mean, there must be just even though you've been doing this for years, it's probably a very tiny percentage of the, universe that you're pointing at, right?
Well, yes. That's when people ask, why haven't you found anything? I mean, one possibility for why we haven't found anything, and of course, that's a difference between SETI and the UFO community. We don't claim that we found anything so far. I think the most rational explanation for that is simply the sample size is too small. I mean, we've only looked at a few thousand star systems. That's pretty small. There are, 100 billion star systems at least in our galaxy, and that means there are probably, a trillion, at least a trillion planets in our galaxy. But there are 2 trillion other galaxies, and one could consider all of those as being possible habitats for life of some sort. But, of course, if you look at other galaxies, you're looking very much farther away than when you look in our own galaxy. And that means that any signals and so forth are, probably a little bit less motivated. Why would you want to send a signal to a galaxy 10 million light years away? And secondly, of course, the signals would be much weaker. So we tend to concentrate on the star systems in our own galaxy.
And how sensitive is the equipment? I mean, to say, you're projecting a signal, like, say, from here, from Earth, and by the time it hits our nearest star, how weak are these signals? And they must be very weak with all the distance.
Well, the distance, of course, does weaken them in the same sense that, distance weakens the beam from your laser pointer. I mean, it's exactly the same degree of weakening. It goes as the square of the distance. But on the other hand, I mean, radio technology is very, very sensitive, and if you have a transmitter with maybe 100,000 watt power behind it, and that's not really so much. I mean, there are transmitters that big even here on Earth. And you hook that up with a big antenna, then you can make a beam that is intense enough to pick up from hundreds of light years away, even with equipment that really isn't much different from the kind of stuff we build ourselves. So even now, only a century after Marconi, if you will, and Tesla, we have radio technology that could communicate between the stars.
And what did you think about the people that have said, I just can't pull his name out right now, recently passed away, and he said, we do not want to connect with aliens out there. Who am I thinking of in the wheelchair?
Well, probably Stephen Hawking.
That's exactly who it is. I don't know why I couldn't think of his name. Terrible. But, yeah, what did you think about his saying? We don't want to be, he was afraid that they're hostile. And that's speculation, of course.
Well, I think what Stephen Hawking was saying was not to do SETI, because SETI is totally passive. We're just listening.
Right.
There's clearly no danger in listening. Yeah. The aliens have no idea whether you're listening or not. But what he was referring to was the possibility that you transmit either de novo by saying, I'm just going to send out a message, hi, we're the Earthlings, get in touch, which some people have done and want to do. Or you do that if you find a signal and, you respond to it and say, hey, we just picked up something from your world, love to start a conversation, whatever. And all he said was that, well, since you don't know what's at the other end, maybe you should be careful. Now, that was not a new idea. That idea has been kicked around for at least two decades. And of course, when Stephen Hawking weighs in on it, everybody pays attention. Whereas when other people have talked about it at length, you know, not necessarily so much attention. But I personally don't buy any of that myself. I mean, yes, you don't know whether the aliens are hostile or otherwise. You can make guesses, but do you want to run the risk of destroying Earth because you guessed wrong? I mean, that doesn't sound like a good idea. But on the other hand, we're broadcasting into space all the time.
That's right.
In particular, yeah. Our radars are very strong. And you know, a lot of the sky is covered with radars. So, you know, it's too late to worry about it.
And, you know, the technology that you're looking for, I remember in a conversation when we were talking the very first time, I said something like, how would you know that a civilization out there would be transmitting and something that you could actually pick up? And I think your phrase or one of the things you said was, it's better than doing nothing. It's better than looking for nothing. And I had to agree with you. Yeah, it's definitely better than, you know, not trying to figure it out. What is the type of range of signals that SETI is now looking in? I mean, you're saying your technology is growing. Does that mean the range, the spectrum of the signals have changed as well?
Well, I think what you're trying to ask is, you know, what do we look for? I mean,
yeah.
Is that the question?
Yeah, I know. I'm a layman, so yeah, maybe I didn't get it across. But yeah, basically, what exactly are you trying to – what type of technology – are you looking for?
Well, when it comes to radio SETI, which is mostly what we do, that may be historical more than anything else. We look for, you know, signals that are in the microwave band of the spectrum, which is roughly from 1,000 megahertz up to 10,000 megahertz, maybe 15,000 megahertz. There are good reasons in both physics and astronomy why that might be the best place to look for signals. And we look for signals that are narrow band. In other words, they're confined in frequency. They're at one spot on the radio dial, if you will, just the way your favorite, you know, talk show host is at one spot on the radio dial. You know, it's 104.5 megahertz on the dial, whatever it is. And that's the indicator that signal was produced by a transmitter. If you have natural radio transmitters, which there are plenty of, I mean, pulsars, quasars, everybody knows about these things, they're all over the dial. They're not really restricted to any one part of the dial. So it's easy to tell that a signal is coming from somebody's technology, somebody's engineering. It's a transmitter if it's localized in frequency.
I see. Okay. Did you happen to catch the article recently that it was a former NASA scientist said something like that he believes that there is going to be an announcement sooner or later, or that we actually know. I think he said something like we actually have a really good idea that there's been signs of life found on Mars. Did you happen to read that, catch that?
Well, I'm not sure that I got the reference correct here, but you may be referring to the director of planetary exploration at NASA. That's Jim Green. And he claimed that we may find life on Mars within 5 years, but we may not be prepared.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, yes.
I read that when it first came out, and I didn't have it up in front of me.
Yeah. No, NBC asked me to write a commentary on that, which I did. And I actually passed it by Jim Green before I sent it to NBC. but I know Jim Green fairly well, so that was, I hope, not an imposition on him. But what he was saying was this. I think it was largely misinterpreted, his comments, particularly by the British tabloids, who tend to misinterpret almost everything.
Right.
What he was saying is this. We haven't looked for life on Mars. When I say we, I mean NASA. The Europeans have done more, but NASA hasn't looked for life on Mars since 1976, when it sent the Viking landers to the surface of our little ruddy buddy up there. And it was probably because of the ambiguous results that came back from the Viking landers that NASA decided, okay, we're not going to do that again, spend $1 billion and still not be sure whether we'd found life or not found life. So they've been very tentative. All the rovers and orbiters and so forth that have been, you know, thrown against Mars are only looking for where the water might be or places where the water might have been, that kind of thing, right? And then they'll go back with something else. But Green was referring to new rovers that are going to go up and actually look for biology. And what he meant when he said that if we find it, we may not be prepared, it wasn't that he figured, oh, we're going to find little green guys that are going to, you know, want to invade the Earth and who knows what come for our fast food. I mean, that isn't what he was saying. What he was saying is we don't know what the next steps should be. If we find microbes on Mars, for example, 2 meters down below the surface, what do we do next? Do we say to Elon Musk, hey, man, you know, lay off. Don't take anybody to Mars. There are Martians. And sure, they're microscopic, but it's their planet. I mean, do we know whether we would buy that argument or would we not buy that argument? So what he was saying is he didn't know whether we had thought through the consequences, not just these sorts of things, but also what science would you try and do next? You know, what spacecraft would you want to build if you actually did find evidence for Martians dead or alive, you know, on the red planet?
Interesting. And as far as intelligent life, I had, oh, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had Jeffrey Bennett on this show. He was a astrophysicist, and he also was at NASA for a while. And he said that he had a conversation with a few of his colleagues there, and they had come up with the thought that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that if a society, an intelligent society, could get it through the bottleneck of technology without blowing themselves up, that they'd probably be traveling the stars. And I just wondered if you ever heard a similar thought.
Well, I don't know whether Jeff was that's probably an original thought with Jeff, although I've written articles about that thought. And maybe I'd heard about that. I mean, Jeff is a guy I know. I wrote a book with him.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I know. Yes. In fact, he's going to be coming to the SETI Institute in a couple of weeks.
Great guy.
Yes, he is a wonderful guy. He has the number one astronomy textbook, and he and I have the number one astrobiology textbook for college kids. But in any case, I think it's true. This was my argument in any case. I'm not sure how Jeff has raised this, but if you invent the H-bomb, right? And you might say, okay, that's the beginning of the end for society. But on the other hand, you invent the H-bomb at about the same time you invent rockets, because after all, you need rockets to carry the H-bombs around, right? So, you know, within hundreds of years, you know, the two are simultaneous in any technological society's development. And so just at the point where you could wipe yourself out, you also have the technology to spread yourselves out and, you know, put people into orbit, you know, orbiting colonies or maybe on the moon or Mars, in our case, get some people off the planet. And once you've done that, I think it's very hard to get rid of everybody. I mean, you know, you could let all the nukes loose tomorrow. I actually made an estimate of how many people that would kill. It turns out at best, it can only kill about a third of the population. There are going to be plenty of people left over. So, you know, but let's even say you could get rid of everybody that way. There's still those people, you know, on your Mars colony or the moon colony or in orbit around the Earth or in orbit around the sun. And so there's no way of getting rid of Homo sapiens, right? So I do think that there is this very narrow bit of time, this very limited bit of time, where you have the capability to do yourself in and still haven't spread out a little bit so you can avoid, you know, killing everybody. And that's the bottleneck. And I don't imagine that it lasts more than 50 years. So that's a pretty short period of time compared to the history of our species.
And what about you must have heard people talk, Elon Musk, for one, is, and you did a great show on AI, artificial intelligence. I really enjoyed that one a lot. Actually, you had some great people on that one. But, you know, that we could, you know, create self-replicating machines that would, you know, continue to work until they destroyed everyone on Earth, that type of thing. What are your thoughts on you know, artificial intelligence as far as that goes. I don't know if you actually brought that up during your show.
No, I don't know that I did. But look, artificial intelligence, I do think, is a very serious development, because for the first time, we're kind of inventing our own successors, if you want to look at it that way. And it's true that artificial intelligence today is very limited in what it can do. And, you know, the only threat it poses is that if you have a job, and some guy who works in AI said this at a luncheon I was at not too long ago. He said, if your job is fairly repetitive, like filling out tax forms or something like that, he says you have 10 years. Okay. And I remember when he said that, well, I said, well, okay, but that's a repetitive job. And somebody else in the audience said, well, what if my job isn't repetitive? You know, I'm a novelist, or I do something creative. How long do I have then? And the guy didn't answer the question. He just smiled at the audience. So, you know, I do think that there's the potential to invent machines that essentially can do anything cognitively that we can do. And of course, one thinks, oh, gosh, now we have a machine that's as smart as my next door neighbor, although maybe not as smart as me, kind of thing. But the point is that that machine will develop its own successor. It'll design the next generation of smart machine. And so unlike humans, these machines will get very, very much smarter very, very quickly. And within 20 years, you have one machine that's smarter than all humans put together. That doesn't happen with biology. That isn't going to happen with us. We're not any smarter than we were 10,000 years ago, to be honest. And so, you know, that's why it's a little unpredictable what's going to happen, certainly in the longer term.
Oh, I agree with you about people being smart. You know, any smarter or less smart is just different things developed over the years. I remember there was something online for you to take as far as a test goes, and it was very, very difficult. It ended up being like a fourth grade test in the 18th century or something like that. You know, I mean, you know, it's funny how some people look back in time and think that people weren't as smart as they are now. It's just that.
Yeah, that's obviously unrealistic, is a bit of a conceit. On the other hand, one shouldn't be intimidated by the kind of evidence you just mentioned, because, of course, in the 18th century, not everybody went to school. Only those who, you know, had opportunity, who came from, the better class, the wealthier class, and consequently, maybe the schools could be a little harder.
Right, right. I did something really quick on this. I'm a fine arts appraiser, and I also understand how the old English was written, and I transcribed a 6-page George Washington letter, had to use a dictionary 20 times, and there wasn't one single misspell in those 6 pages. Pretty amazing.
Well, yeah. he was not a dummy.
I know we're way off topic. But anyway, as far as the average astronomer that you know, are friends with or whatever, do you think it's pretty much across the board that there's an idea that there's most likely intelligent life out there?
Well, I certainly haven't, you know, surveyed them, so I don't really know. You know, the people I talk to all seem to be fairly sanguine, fairly optimistic that there's intelligence out there, because if not, then there's got to be something very special about what's happened here on Earth. There are people who maintain that there is something special about what's happened here. I mean, you know, one easy example is 66 million years ago, an asteroid hits the Earth, wipes out the dinos, and 2/3 of everything else, by the way, all other species. But, you know, if that asteroid had arrived 30 minutes earlier, it would have missed the Earth entirely, and you and I would not be having this conversation. There would be dinosaurs here in California. Some would say there still are, I suppose. But in any case, you know, so that suggests that, well, you know, the dinosaurs were around for 150 million years, and they never got very smart, right? They were never building radio transmitters. They never, you know, developed a, you know, reality television. So it suggests that, you know, nature's not particularly interested in intelligence. Nature's only interested in survival. And so maybe there are just zillions of planets out there with life, but no intelligence. That's possible. Some people would argue that. I personally find that special pleading. So I don't know that that's actually true. But there's some who do.
Yeah, yeah. And then also we are, like you said, we're kind of a young species compared to what else we can compare on Earth. But we're also a young solar system, a young planet compared to a lot of what is out there. And, you know, when you get to thinking about our technology and the possible technology of a, say, a society that's been around for as long as the dinosaurs were, 150 million years. I mean, that would be incredible. I mean, look at what we've done in the last 100 years as far as technology goes. And this is when, you know, we can speculate all kinds of things about space travel or, you know, time travel or whatever it is that could be figured out with the amount of time and technology. And, you know, what do you think about as far as technology out there and the length of time that, you know, a species could be around?
Well, I don't know that there's any limit. I mean, we've already talked a little bit about artificial intelligence and whether AI is our future, not just in terms of, you know, whether it takes our jobs or whether it, you know, helps us in the old folks' home or anything like that, but whether it indeed, you know, quickly becomes the dominant intelligence on this planet. And if that's the case, and I think that it probably is the case, but we'll have to see. If that happens, some of this intelligence is going to get kind of bored hanging around Earth. I mean, Earth is fairly interesting and all, but, you know, if you're a machine and you can travel because you don't die, you can travel any distance you want, then, you know, some of those machines may just get up and leave. So I think that it's hardly radical to suggest that the dominant intelligence in the universe is not biological at all. It's just machine intelligence. And so if you ask, well, how long could that kind of intelligence survive? It's, you know, it's, I mean, eventually the universe becomes kind of uninteresting in terms of energy sources. And, you know, but that's 10 to the 100 years. That's when the last big black hole burns up. So that's a long time. And these machines will have plenty of time to do whatever it is that smart machines want to do.
Do you think that there's a possibility of us figuring out here on Earth, us figuring out a way to travel, you know, faster than the speed of light? I know that's really out there, but there are people that are theorizing that there that light speed may not be the end of the speed. You know, I mean, what do you think the future of space travel? I mean, could do you think it's possible that we could actually get to the stars at some point?
Well, we could get to the stars if you just go fast enough. You don't have to break the speed of light barrier. But as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, you know, your own clock slows down. That's just special relativity. So from your point of view, you know, you could go if you have a spacecraft with enough energy sources that you can go that fast. I mean, if you can. And if you don't mind the fact that the front of the ship is encountering all this, you know, these interstellar, the interstellar gas, all these atoms that are going to make for very hard radiation inside the rocket and give you instant cancer. I mean, there are all sorts of, you know, technical problems, but those are only technical problems. At least they don't violate physics. The real question, if you talk about faster than light travel, you know, warp drive, whatever that means, then you're up against physics, because if you can go faster than the speed of light, then it turns out that there are problems with causality in physics, that the effects precede the causes. And that messes physics up in a way that's so distasteful that, you know, scientists, including, of course, Al Einstein, wouldn't allow that. Now, you know, one should never say never, and maybe there are ways out of this, and obviously, you know, big black holes and so forth might afford you a cheat to go faster than the speed of light. But it's very unclear whether you can actually go through a big black hole or anything like that, come out the other end and know anything about it. So it's unclear. At this point, you know, again, it's simply the realm of science fiction. And beyond that, nobody knows. If we knew, it wouldn't be science fiction anymore.
Yeah. I know a lot of people are inspired that get into astronomy and space work basically are inspired by science fiction to begin with as, you know, in their youth. There was a question up on the message board. Someone wanted to know what you thought about. I always have trouble saying it. The out of galaxy, I mean, the out of solar system Oumuamua. Oh, it's a Hawaiian Oumuamua name. Yeah. What do you think about that? And isn't there another one that they say is coming through? Another
yes.
type of
yes.
out of?
Yeah. Oumuamua was found about 2.5 years ago, something like that, using a telescope in Hawaii. And that's why it has a nice Hawaiian name, Oumuamua. Mm-hmm. What was interesting about it is that it's not from this solar system. For the first time, we found a rock from somebody else's solar system. And you could say that's remarkable. And it sort of is, except for the fact that, you know, it was the first time we had telescopes that could easily find such things. But the question is, was it just a rock? Was it just a dead comet? Or could it be, a la Rendezvous with Rama, you know, the Arthur C. Clarke story? Could it be an interstellar spacecraft piloted by a bunch of Klingons or something? And that idea was considered seriously by the head of the Harvard Astronomy Department, who pointed out that, look, this thing came right into, you know, the central regions of our solar system. That's an awfully good targeting for an object that, you know, is completely natural and was just, you know, kicked out of its own solar system by perfectly natural processes. You know, that would make a lot more sense if there was some navigation on board. So he was arguing that one should not rule out the possibility that Oumuamua was, in fact, a manufactured thing and not a natural asteroid or comet. But in the last couple of months, this amateur in Russia, I think he's in the Ukraine, actually, should be careful about that. And it's not the Ukraine, it's in Ukraine. I hope he'll forgive me for all that. But this thing was found, and it's also not from our solar system. You can tell that by its orbit. And it now has the name 2I for interstellar, 2I Borisov. And Borisov is the name of the guy who found it, so that's why it has his name. But that's clearly a comet. It has a tail, right? It has the colors of a comet. It's headed toward the inner solar system, and it will get closer to us around Christmas time. Not very close, but closer.
And I guess we're going to be seeing part of the tail of Halley's Comet? I just saw something about we're going to be seeing, I thought it was Halley's Comet. We're going to be seeing part of that or traces of that soon.
I think
in the sky?
At least a half a century before Halley's Comet gets close to us again. But.
Right. I read something today, though, that's saying it's not that, but it's traces of it or something that is going to be visible. Anyway, I may be thinking of something else. Someone put a good question in the chat room. Could SETI find Earth from the nearest solar system?
Yeah, I think they could. I mean, there are some radars. The strongest signals being launched from Earth are indeed the radars. And, you know, if you had the good fortune to be in the beam of the Arecibo radar, that's the antenna down in Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah.
Which has a 2-megawatt transmitter emitter on board of it, as I recall. That you could see from very, very far away, actually, with the kind of SETI equipment that we have. But let's assume that, that's only a 1 in 10 million shot that you're in the line of that radar. So the question is, you know, could you see any of the others? And I think you could. I think you could. I mean, you know, it depends on how long you're willing to look and some of the details of the receiver and so forth. But certainly the signal strength would be enough. And if the aliens have been in the SETI business longer than we have, they undoubtedly have bigger antennas and better receivers and probably could pick up all sorts of stuff. If they had covered, you know, some real estate the size of, I don't know, the Sonora Desert with rooftop TV antennas, they could even pick up the carrier signals from our television transmitters. I don't know if that would interest them, but at least they would know somebody's home.
Hmm. Now, what about the gases on a planet? You know, that would take a whole different type of instrumentation, right, to figure out if they could find methane in a planet far away. Or is that through spectrum?
Well, that you do with optical telescopes, unless mm-hmm. you're talking about gases like, you know, Exxon or, you know, Sinclair or maybe. I mean, but if you're talking about the composition of the atmosphere, you do that with a conventional telescope, which is to say a mirror and lens kind of telescope. And that's indeed one of the briefs for it's about to be launched. It's the successor to Hubble, the James Webb.
James Webb.
Yeah, brain fade there. Yeah, the James Webb.
I've had telescope, a few tonight.
The James Webb Telescope will be launched in probably 2 years. Nobody knows. It keeps getting postponed a little bit. But when that's up there, you know, it's conceivable that it will have enough sensitivity, enough collecting area to look at some planets around stars that are relatively nearby. And if you will, sort of sample the air around those planets, the atmospheres, if they have atmospheres, and make spectral analyses and tell you things like, well, is there any oxygen in those atmospheres, which would be an interesting datum because that would suggest that there's also biology there. You know, and methane, of course, is another gas that would indicate some biology, probably.
Yeah, probably. I know. What I was talking about earlier, it says it's a meteor shower made by Halley's Comet. So that peaks tonight. That's what the news I read.
Yeah, well, there are a lot, you know, as you know, there are many meteor showers, particularly in the early fall here in the Northern Hemisphere, and almost all of them are the consequence of rubble that's broken off of comets staying in orbit and eventually, you know, flying into our atmosphere.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's interesting. So as far as people are putting some questions in chat, someone wants to know what your thoughts are on the Vatican's telescopes. Or telescope?
Well, I don't know too much about the Vatican's telescope, but they have a very strong astronomy program. I've been to the Vatican Observatory, actually, in Italy years and years ago. But, you know, they also have telescopes here and elsewhere. I mean, they're around the world. And there's a rather well-known Vatican astronomer, Brother Guy Consolmagno, who is, you know, he's even written a book. I think the name of his last book was Would You Baptize an Alien? So that's an interesting question. But yeah, no, the Vatican Observatory, you know, they probably have bad press simply because of that whole thing with Galileo. But on the other hand, they've always been interested in this, and they are increasingly so.
Right, right. I think that's pretty amazing. And, a question that has come up a couple of times in the chat room is, I guess we're going to get in a little bit into the subject of UFOs. And I would imagine that someone like you I remember when you and I talked last time, you told me you get about, I thought you said something like 4,000 emails a month or something crazy like that. But do you get a lot of people that contact you about UFOs?
I do. In fact, I just gave a talk about this at CFICon in Las Vegas 48 hours ago. And, well, it's like 50 hours ago now. But on the fact that essentially every day I get emails or phone calls from people who have seen something or experienced something and they want to know what it was. So, yes, plenty of people get in touch with me about UFOs. And, in fact, next week at this time, will it be at this time? No, it'll be sooner than that. I guess it's on Saturday morning. I'll be debating Nick Pope, who's well known in the UFO.
Oh, yeah.
I think Nick Pope at the Jasper Dark Sky Festival in glamorous, lovely Jasper, Alberta, up in Canada. So, I do. I mean, I don't do UFO research myself, but I certainly deal with a lot of people who call me up and want to report something. And, you know, they send me photos and videos.
And I'm sure you're just your general personality. You're kind to them. But, you know, it's probably, is it something you actually respond to and just say that it's not something I, want to attempt to answer? Or do you pass them along to, say, MUFON or something like that?
Well, I suggest to all of them that they get in touch with MUFON. But I do. I mean, I ask them, I mean, if it's just a, you know, they've seen something, if they don't say anything more, there's not much I can say. But I usually ask if they have any photos or videos. And if so, whether they wanted to send them to me, because I would give them an opinion of what I think they are. And about half of them do that. Photography is actually something I've done for a long time. So very often I can look at the photos or the videos and venture a guess as to what they're actually, you know, seeing in those videos and photos. Nobody ever thanks me for those kinds of explanations, by the way.
Oh, yes. They don't want to hear. I've had to do that myself. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do. I mean, there are some that are simply, you know, I don't know what it is. Okay. I mean, that's often the case with these sorts of things. But of course, the fact that you don't know what it is hardly a proof that it's, you know, extraterrestrial or anything. I mean, that's an argument from ignorance. You say, I don't know what it is, so it's probably extraterrestrial. That's obviously a very weak argument.
I'm careful on the show not to, I'll say possibly, you know, possibly extraterrestrial, but that's only a possibility because I, as long as I've been doing the show, the more I do it, the more I realize that there's less I know about, you know, what people are seeing. So I think when we first actually debated, I think that I was using that term a little more heavily, saying that, you know, thinking that what we were seeing was most likely aliens. Now I have absolutely no idea, but I do know that there's technology that is just unexplainable. And I wanted to get your opinion of someone else also asked in the chat room of, have you followed any of this USS Nimitz case and what has, you know, what has been revealed through that? And, you know, the fact that the Pentagon was actually doing some serious research into the topic.
Yeah, well, I know that they're unidentified aerial phenomena, as they like to call them these days. You know, they stopped the program. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, it already cost $22 million. They decided, well, they weren't coming up with anything very interesting.
Well, there's a debate on whether that stopped or not. But anyway.
Yeah, maybe they didn't. Yeah. Maybe they didn't. But if the best they could come up with were those videos, I would say, well, the videos are certainly intriguing, although I've heard various explanations for what they could be that don't involve aliens at all. So all you can say is, well, I mean, it could be that or it could be this or it could be that. And then that's obviously not good enough. That doesn't prove anything. That just means you don't know what it is. So, but I am familiar. I mean, I've looked at the videos quite a bit and I've shown them to other people who've actually flown for the military and stuff like that. And they give their opinions of what they are. None of them has said that it's an alien craft, but, you know, there are people out there who do think it is.
Have you actually listened to any of David Fravor's testimony, the fighter pilot that encountered the Tic Tac?
Yeah, I have, but only, you know, in videos that are posted on the internet. So I wasn't there for the testimony.
Yeah. Well, some of the radar and the eyewitness and that collaborate some very spectacular things. Again, I'm not saying alien, but I'm saying of craft that, for instance, I forget, something like produced what would cause 1,300 G's of force.
Well, how do you know that it was 1,300 G's?
Because they had it tracked on radar from. I think it was 28,000 feet down to the top of the ocean in less than a second. And so that was tracked on radar.
But you can get a reflection from, you know, a radar beam. You get a second reflection from someplace else. And suddenly, if you say, oh, they're from the same object, then you say, oh, my God, that was an incredible velocity. But, of course, there's a big assumption in that.
But there was also, David Fravor is one of the witnesses that actually saw this thing behaving in such, you know, strange maneuvers and, you know, shot off. He didn't get a speed when he saw it shot off, of course. But, you know, the maneuvering was just, it's just unexplainable.
Well, I would never say something's unexplainable. I think that's
in our technology.
No, I think what you're saying, what you really mean to say is it's unexplained. To say it's unexplainable is to say that, you know, humans are just not smart enough to ever figure this out. And, you know, that's a hard thesis to prove, I think. And well, one thing that I noticed about the videos or the claims here by the Navy pilots, to begin with, I often wonder, why is it that the aliens are so clever that they only make themselves visible to the military, and only to our military for some reason, it seems. But, you know, whereas Travis Walton had no trouble seeing aliens, but somehow all the good evidence only appears to the military. I think that there's something rather suspicious about that, because in this case, the military was using new technology. These infrared gun sight cameras were new. Some people told me, they said, you know, this is just a defect in the cameras. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly a possibility, and one shouldn't rule that out. The other thing is that the East Coast sightings, as I recall, the pilot said, yeah, they could see this stuff every day or almost every day. Well, if that's the case, I mean, off the eastern seaboard, there are thousands of commercial ships of all varieties, freighters and fishermen and all this stuff. And if these pilots could see this stuff so obviously with their eyeballs every day, why is it that these guys, these other people don't ever see it?
Well, not to say that they have or haven't, you know, I mean, that people have, you know, I mean, I was at a conference one time when someone asked how many people think they saw a UFO. And then there was like 100 hands, let's just say. And then how many of you reported a UFO that you saw? And it was a tiny fraction of people actually raised their hands.
No, a tiny fraction is still not zero.
That's right. And are we saying that zero other people saw these things? I don't know. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Yeah, well, the
if
number
there were
of
other witnesses, but there's been plenty of witnesses other than the military that have seen, you know, UFOs. Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you then, Martin, since you clearly think that the evidence is good for visitation, what would you cite as the best evidence, the evidence you would put in the Smithsonian on display? Which is the convincing case?
You're talking about physical evidence. And
well, I'm talking about something you have to show. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Why don't you do the same thing with dark matter then?
Well, I actually found the physical evidence for that, and it was the rotation speed of galaxies.
And can you put that in the Smithsonian?
Well, sure,
what's
you
your point?
It's like Newton's law. You can put Newton's law in the Smithsonian, right?
All right.
I mean,
so
it is Newton's law. In fact, fundamentally, it's that. And that's easy enough to demonstrate by, you know, just looking at the positions of the stars, or Newton's law, you can, you know, examine by looking at the position of an apple as you drop it from a tree. It's all very easily demonstrable. But if I were to ask you, what's the best case, even if you don't want to put it in the Smithsonian, apparently nobody does, what would you say it was?
Well, when you're saying putting something in the Smithsonian, to me, it sounds like physical evidence, and which, you know, there is no physical evidence that we have. There's a possibility of metamaterials. But I don't know. I don't hold much faith in that, that are being looked at, actually, that are being looked at by the Army as well. And this was recently came out. But as far as something you'd put in the Smithsonian, it's along the lines of a lot of astronomy. It's observational. You know, people have seen things, witnessed things, multiple witnesses, mass sightings. And I'm not saying they're alien. I'm saying we don't know what they are. It's something, in my opinion, that science isn't taking seriously enough. Because what if it was somehow threatening aviation or something like that?
I mean, well, when you go to the airport, you know, to check in and get aboard the aircraft, and you're sitting there on the tarmac, do you frequently have the experience that the pilot will come on and say, "Well, folks, there's some unidentified flying objects here in the area. They haven't filed a flight plan, so we're just going to sit here on the tarmac till they clear the area." I mean, does that happen a lot?
No. But, I mean, I'm sure you probably heard of the O'Hare case. You know, that was one in particular that happened, yeah, you know, at an airport.
It did happen at an airport, but it wasn't because there were flying objects. There was a strange cloud formation that zoomed up, right? And
that wasn't a strange cloud formation. There was too many people that saw a perfectly shaped disk, and then they saw it shoot up through the clouds. But again,
what are you saying it is? What are you saying it is?
There are people that reported seeing a disc, many people. And there was actually someone that actually saw it that was landing in a plane, too, that talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is all witness testimony, and you know, there's no hard evidence. But I just want to ask you this question. How come you think there's such a ridicule factor in actually trying to figure these things out?
Well, a lot of it is, to begin with, a lot of it is witness testimony. You just said that yourself. There's no worse bit of evidence for anything in science than witness testimony, right? Newton didn't say F equals MA on the basis of witness testimony. He did some experiments, but actually he just did it all in his head. And then he went out and found some data on the motions of the planets, and it turned out he could explain all of that stuff and predict where they were going to be. All right. Okay. So witness testimony, I mean, you can hear, you know, lots of scientists say that. It's pretty much worthless. If you've ever been on a jury, you know, particularly in a criminal case, and you have to, you know, take people to a lineup or something and say, so which guy here did this? You know, that's very unreliable. That usually juries don't pay much attention to that because it's so unreliable. So witness testimony, I think you have to rule out. If that's all you've got, I say you don't have much. It's got to be better. The other thing I notice, particularly in the UFO community these days, is that a lot of people are placing their bets on what they call disclosure. And I'm sure you're familiar with the idea here that there is really good evidence for all of this, and the U.S. government has it, and they will soon release it to the public. And these Navy videos are just another indication that the truth is coming out.
I don't buy into that.
No? Okay. No. I don't either, but I just wonder whether you did.
Yeah. No, I don't buy into that. I think that it's possible that, you know, over the years, there's been a number of cases where the government has confiscated things. For instance, on the Nimitz case, they confiscated the some of the footage and radar records data.
Why would they do that?
They did. It was witnessed by a number of people.
No, but why would they do that?
Well, I don't know exactly why. And, you know, it'd be just speculating. But there's been a number of cases where the government has confiscated footage. There's a couple of accounts of that, one from an astronaut that actually witnessed something. But I don't know if the government knows.
I'm just sort of curious, if I can interrupt you, Martin.
Sure.
Which astronaut was that? Because I know a lot of the astronauts.
Gordon Cooper.
Gordon Cooper. Yeah. I also knew Edgar Mitchell quite well. And
yeah,
also,
nice guy. Yeah.
Yeah, Story Musgrave. He also claims he could hear the aliens' music in the muffin fans.
I asked him about that because he was on my show. So yeah. I told him, I said your quote that you just said right now. I said, Seth Shostak said that you said that. And he said, what? He acted like he had no idea what you were talking about. But anyway.
Well, I met him in person when he said it. But okay, good enough. Listen, the thing is that, you know, eyewitness testimony, I'll repeat it again. I mean, you know, I know quite a few of the astronauts, and they're wonderful people. But, you know, you don't decide matters of science, or in this case, something that would be incredibly interesting on the basis of witness testimony. You can't do that. If you do, then, you know, it's just too weak. It has no predictive power. It has no quantitative power. It's just somebody's story. And you can say, well, this person is a military pilot. Well, as somebody who was a military pilot pointed out to me, he said military pilots are trained to recognize other military aircraft.
Right.
Not trained. To recognize alien craft. So I would say that what you have to do is just find some evidence that's quantitative.
Would you consider witness testimony backed up by eyewitnesses, not something
witness
that should
testimony
be looked at?
Backed up by eyewitnesses?
I'm sorry, backed up by radar data.
Well, radar is very ambiguous itself, actually. Anybody who works in radar knows that. And my father was involved with radar. I mean, you can get radar reflections from the atmosphere, okay? So radar reflections per se are not necessarily – but it's another – you know what would convince me? Just looking this up. There are 770 satellites orbiting the Earth that are imaging satellites. They're looking at the Earth making imagery. Okay, and you know everybody knows about some of these, like the satellites that produce those weather maps you see every night on the news, and of course the military has a lot of imaging satellites for reconnaissance, and not just the U.S. Obviously, you know there are a dozen countries I'm sure at least that have these things. Okay, and they actually survey the entire planet about once a day, and typically have resolution of about 1 meter. They don't see any of this stuff. Why is that?
Well, a lot of I can understand that in a way where a lot of people will say that when they're eyewitnessing or even on radar have seen something in one spot and then all of a sudden it's somewhere else. And again, you know, you keep bringing up aliens and possible coming in from outer space. I don't know if that's what these things are. But
are you saying they're not aliens?
I don't know. All I'm saying is I don't know. But I know that there's something to it. And also, you know, you talk about the radar imperfections. And I think radar is another technology that has gotten much better over the years. And I don't think you're going to be getting from all these different angles and all these different radars that are seeing one thing, the same thing happen. I don't think that's going to be some atmospheric inversion or whatever you said it was myself. I mean, all I'm trying to say, Seth, is I think these things are unexplainable, and I think they should be looked at more seriously by science instead of
just the ridicule. But if they're unexplainable, why look at them again? I don't get it, Martin.
What's that?
If they're unexplainable, what good does it do to look at them again?
Well, unexplainable by what we know, but aren't you curious as a scientist to figure out?
No, okay, okay. So again, you meant unexplained, right?
Unexplained, okay.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Now we should keep looking. After all, I mean, if this is true, right? I mean, you know, there was this British theoretician said to me, Shostak, if I thought there was a 1% chance any of this was true, I'd spend all my time working on it. Well, clearly he doesn't believe that there's even a 1% chance that it's true. But if you can come up with evidence that shows that there is at least a 1% chance that it's true, then you're going to have thousands of scientists working on it. The fact that they're not says a lot to me. You know, scientists are not, you know, they're not so close-minded that they wouldn't be interested in the most interesting story you could have.
I think the holdback on a lot of people in the science world is the ridicule factor. I mean, my last guest, you know, mentioned that. You know, that's he is actually a scientist looking into this. He actually had a sighting. He didn't know what it was, but. You know, when he was young, and that got him more interested in, you know, taking a hard look at this.
Is he at a university somewhere? Is he getting ridicule from other
people?
Yeah,
he's not getting ridicule, but he's saying there is the ridicule factor out there, and that's why scientists aren't taking a hard look at this.
I don't buy that at all. I don't think that's true at all. There was ridicule factor in claiming that the bones that were being found in Britain, you know, 200 years ago were due to animals that once roamed the earth. Right.
Well, Seth, I feel as though I'm getting a little ridicule from you, you know, as we're having this conversation. Like,
okay,
basically, why am I wasting my time on it? I feel that from you. So, you know, I mean, are you ridiculing people that look at UFOs?
No, I just said I'm perfectly happy for people to look into it because if there is something here. It would be good to know. It's just that the evidence that is presented so far is, to my mind, simply unconvincing.
Well, in my mind, it's unconvincing what SETI's turned up too, but you're still looking, right?
But we don't claim that we found something. So what's unconvincing about it?
Well, I'm just saying you are looking for something that hasn't been found. We don't have evidence. We haven't found evidence that we can hand over to the Smithsonian, like you say, but I still think it's really worth the time in looking into it.
But Martin, I didn't understand your comment. Why is SETI unconvincing to you?
You haven't found anything.
Well, but that's not a matter of unconvincing. That's just saying that we haven't found anything.
Well, I'm just saying your argument, you know, is basically it's kind of the same argument. We haven't found any evidence of UFOs that we can say that, you know, there's still evidence to be found, but there's something going on. Some people, there's way too many people seeing something.
Okay, so that's the difference. You're making the claim that there is something going on.
I think there is something definitely going on, yes.
Okay, well, that's the difference between the UFO hypothesis and the SETI hypothesis. The SETI hypothesis, you're quite right, has not found a signal yet. We find signals all the time, but we haven't found a signal yet that's, you know, convincing and compelling. Many people know about the WOW signal, for example.
In the 70s, right? Yeah.
Sorry?
The 1970s, wasn't that all the way back then?
Yes, that was in 1974, as I recall. But, no, sorry, 1977. Yeah, but, you know, that didn't meet the standards of science, which is to say it was repeatable and you could find it again. That hasn't happened. So, you know, whatever it was, we don't know what it is, and we don't claim that it was ET. But the UFO community often takes the point of view that, no, there is something in our airspace. And that's a difference.
Well, I guess I'm on the same page with them because I think there is something in our airspace. So I know you want to see the evidence of that. If what would convince you, physical evidence only, because there's definitely a lot of radar. And, you know, I know video can be manipulated, but there's even early video. You know, what is convincing enough for you? Actually, something that you can reach out and touch?
Well, that would be great. Yeah, something. I mean, you know, these things are flying around. They don't seem to have much, as I say, much impact. But if they did have an impact, you know, I mean, you know, one of the more famous cases is, of course, Roswell. And that's an old one now. Still very controversial, in my opinion, because there's an alternative explanation for what happened at Roswell that fits all the facts rather nicely. But, of course, if you're convinced that aliens came to New Mexico and crashed, you don't buy into that. But, you know, there was some debris. The debris was identified by the people who were involved with this Project Mogul. And they say, yeah, that's our balloon train. But there are other people saying, no, it was alien crash. But, you know, if it was an alien crash, why was it so limited in size and scope that you could throw it all into a truck and take it 70 miles down to the city of Roswell? I mean, those kinds of things, you know, that isn't good. If it hollowed out a crater 500 feet across and there was all sorts of debris at the bottom of it, okay, that's different, right? But I don't see that kind of evidence.
I don't know. You know, I don't want to get into a Roswell debate with you, but
no,
I will tell you that, you know, the one thing that always has puzzled me about that is why on earth the Army Air Force at the time actually, you know, posted a press release saying that a flying disc was found by them. When if they did find something, if they found a mogul, the Project Mogul or whatever it was they found, they didn't have to say anything. There was no reason for them to say anything. I just think that's the big puzzle of Roswell.
Well, they weren't digging up a mogul. What the Project Mogul was a project.
I know what it is. I'm just saying that even if they had found a Project Mogul balloon system or whatever that they had, I know what that was, you know, supposedly for, so they could see if the Russians were doing anything in the nuclear world. But if they had found something like that, why would they even put anything in the paper at all? You know, I mean, that's just a bizarre.
Well, because it had been in the paper, because that story was out there and they had to respond to it.
No, it was the Army Air Force that actually released the story first.
No, the paper came to them. Look, this guy Brazel, whatever his name, he carries the debris into Roswell. He goes to the newspaper. He shows them this stuff. They say, what is it? He doesn't know what it is.
I think you may be getting your facts a little wrong on that one, Seth, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think you might have that one a little backwards.
So you're saying that the military called up the newspaper and said, run this story?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's out there. Hang on just 1 minute. I know.
When they were called, they gave an explanation. And at first they said it was a weather balloon. And they realized that everybody would know that it wasn't a weather balloon. So they changed the story the next day to a flying disc, right? Or maybe it was the other way around. They had these two stories, and they were trying to distance themselves from the story because, of course, this was a secret operation.
Well. Anyway, I didn't want to go Roswell tonight, but that's okay. Anyway, Seth, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. It's always interesting, and It's kind of fun talking about the UFO topic with someone like you. And good luck with your, I think what you have, you said with Nick Pope, when is that coming up, that debate?
That's Saturday morning.
This coming?
Yep.
Yeah, that should be interesting. All right, you take care.
Okay, thanks very much, Mark.
All right, thank you. All right, everyone, so that's it for the show. And we will be back next week. Our guest next week will be two people. We have Peter Robbins, and we also have Jennifer Stein. They're going to be talking about their film coming up. And I want to thank everyone for hanging out tonight. We went a little longer than normal. All right, everyone. So talk to you later and see you next week. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.